Remaker's Mark, Episode 34, Saving Private Ryan. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Remaker's Mark. Here we are in Episode 34, where we are once again discussing Steven Spielberg's Saving Private Ryan. With me, as always, are my friends Andy Wicks. Andy, how are you doing tonight? And do you have any military history in your family?
I'm very well, thank you. I do have some family history. My dad was actually completing the officer candidate school in the Marines, but he was medically discharged before he could finish it. And then, ironically, was almost drafted by the Army for Vietnam after that, but didn't go.
I assume for being too handsome.
Didn't make it because he was so damn handsome.
Yeah, I believe it.
And then my grandfather and his brother both fought in World War II. My grandfather was in the Navy in a small ship that participated in the Battle of Leyte Gulf. And my great uncle was a fighter pilot, a P-51 pilot, based out of England. I'll keep this story very short. One of his missions over France had to bail out of his plane, landed in the small village of Buzance, and was smuggled out of the country by the French underground.
Wow.
Yeah. Very cool.
Unfortunately, he died shortly after the war, so I never met him, but he sounded like he was quite a character.
No kidding. Wow. Quite the story.
Yeah.
Yikers. Jeremy Nilsson, how are you doing? And do you have any military history in your family?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I do. My grandpa on my mom's side was in the Navy, and he was actually on an aircraft carrier in Tokyo Bay the day that the peace treaty was signed.
Wow.
And he was also in Korea, but he didn't have any stories of note that he told me about that. And both my uncles, his sons, were Rangers of Vietnam. And my mom will shortly be retiring as a lieutenant colonel in the Army Reserves.
Wow.
And she was activated once for several years, 4 or 5 years ago.
Huh. Interesting. There's a lot of family history here. Lee Handgrenade, how are you doing? And how about you? Is there military history in your family?
I'm doing well. And my grandfather on my mom's side was in the Marines during World War II. He was fairly young, so he didn't get there until the very end. But from what I understand, he did fight in Okinawa, which was probably the worst battle of the Pacific War. And my stepdad's dad was in the Navy during World War II, and he, I believe, was based in the Philippines. And I have an uncle on my mom's side who was in Vietnam and was wounded so many times that they sent him home.
Wow.
Jeez.
So he still has shrapnel in his leg, actually.
Wow.
Yikes.
Man. Crazy.
Yep.
Mark Josting, how are you doing? And what is the military history in your family, if any?
I'm great, thanks. I do have a late uncle who was a Navy seaman and a living uncle who was... he's now retired, but he was a surgeon in the Filipino Army.
Wow.
The one that's really interesting to me is my great-grandfather, I believe, fought in the Philippine-American War, which is the Filipino War for Independence from America.
Huh. He fought against America in that war?
He fought against America, and, well, now I'm an American, so I guess suck it, great-grandpa. No, that's terrible.
It's the dream that he always wanted for you.
I disagree with you, great grandson, but I fight for your right to say something.
Except he probably said it in Wolrai, but oh well.
Yeah,
fair enough. It was translated. We've got a babble fish. My name is Kyle Della Hunt. I will be your host once again this fine evening. And my dad was in the Air Force. He was a cop in the Air Force, actually. He was in England and Germany and Montana. Not in order of sexiness. then I had a grandpa that was in Korea, and then a great uncle that was, I don't know where he was actually, but yeah, a fair amount of history there as well. It's fascinating to look at like that generation and now, like how many future podcasters of the world could ask this same question 20 years from now, and what the response would be then. I mean, the generational change in that. I mean, I don't know what the numbers of military servicemen are and women now versus those eras? I mean, obviously there's not, well, I shouldn't say that, there are wars going on, but it's just fascinating to me to see that change and the difference. I think for the better, that's just me. I don't want to put my values on everybody, but that's where I'm at. All right, before we move on to our discussion of Saving Private Ryan, I want to thank our friends at Modern Antics for their promotional consideration.
Modern Antics produces and markets hugely interesting events in bars and other cool places. New from Modern Antics, Riddle Room 2, The Starship, a live room escape game and interactive puzzle set on a fully immersive starship. Participants have 1 hour to solve a series of increasingly challenging puzzles before time runs out. To find out more and purchase tickets, check them out at riddle-room.com or on Facebook at Twitter at Modern Antics.
All right. Thanks again to Modern Antics. Now we want to touch on some feedback that we got from Facebook. We threw it out on Twitter too, but nobody replied. Boo Twitter people, but yay Facebook people. So we threw it out there and just kind of mentioned that we were discussing Saving Private Ryan and just asked what people thought of the original or maybe what they would change. And then also who they might cast in the Tom Hanks and Matt Damon roles. Derek Schilly, frequent contributor here. So Derek, thank you as always. Said Brian J. Smith for Matt Damon. He's in the new show, the new Wachowski series on Netflix, Sense8, which I haven't watched yet, but I've heard good things. So this is entirely based on me watching that show, but he's good in that, and I think close to the right age. So I don't know him, but I'm going to look him up. That's interesting. And then the other comment that he put was Carl Urban is my first thought for Tom Hanks. He might be too pretty. I think you need to be able to believe that he is a regular guy outside of the war. So we talked a lot about that in part one, kind of the everybody. We talked about it with Private Ryan especially, but I think it's especially pertinent with Miller as well, that it's, you know, you need to see him as just a Pennsylvania teacher, not a superhero. So yeah. I think Carl Urban would be a little superhero-y, I agree, or a little too big for the britches, but I like the view of it overall.
Yeah, I do like that pick a lot, Derek Schilly. Not as much as my own pick, but I like it.
And then Elise Robinson said, get rid of the effing framing device, which is the old man at the beginning and the end of the movie. She said, I hate that part and the movie doesn't need it. We'll come back to that. We're going to have a little discussion about Steven Spielberg and his role as a filmmaker and how this movie fits in with that. So stay tuned on that one.
Yeah,
we shall see.
You just hang in there, Elise Robinson.
That's right. We shall get there, I promise. Jared, you want to talk about the next two that you got?
I'm not sure if I do or not. Christopher Stark, who's a old friend, said Dennis Hopper as Private Ryan, who's deceased. Christopher Walken as Captain Miller and James Gandolfini, who's also deceased, as Horvath. And then asked, is there a rule against using dead actors?
I believe we've established precedent on that.
I'm not sure if he quite understood, but even more perplexing is a friend, Dave Westerberg, is a friend of Andy and I. He said R. Lee Ermey as Horvath so he could whip Miller into shape. Tom Hanks as Private Ryan, but playing it like Forrest Gump. Vin Diesel can keep his Caparzo, and Clint Eastwood as Miller, since I can't use John Wayne because of the dead actor rule, but Clint Eastwood from Heartbreak Ridge. So,
Dave, I'm really happy that you wrote in, and it's good to hear from you again. Have you listened to the podcast before?
I'm guessing not.
Just curious.
It's a nice try.
I'm going to try this one. I think all this makes perfect sense if it's directed by David Lynch.
Ah. Oh, that was probably okay. It probably ran out of characters.
That's fair. Yep. That's fair. So that is all the feedback, both good and inexplicable, that we got on Facebook and Twitter. Again, if you want to hit us up on either of those, you can do so at username MathIsHardNet. So let us know what you think of the episode, and feedback, good and bad, is always appreciated. Now, let's talk about our picks from part one. So in part one, we recasted 3 major roles and 5 minor roles, and these are the big, big winners of those. So in the role of Corporal Upham, originally played by Jeremy Davies, we went with Mark's choice of Miles Teller. Well done, Mark.
Yay.
In the role of Private Ryan, originally played by Matt Damon, we went with Mark and Andy's pick of Nicholas Holt. Both of them picked that.
Yay.
So good work, you guys.
Double yay.
In the role of Captain John Miller, originally played by Tom Hanks, we went with Jaren Andy's combined pick in this instance of Nathan Fillion. So
triple
cheaters,
yay!
But good work.
Two heads are better than one.
And for the minor characters, we went with the choice, Jer's choice, in the role of Private Jackson, originally played by Barry Pepper. Jer chose Norman Reedus in that, so that was good. So the winners are Mark and Jaren Andy, although really Mark, because Jaren Andy's combined didn't count. Just
I'm sorry, what? So.
Wow.
Huh?
Who? Umbridge. That's
right.
To the bridge.
To the bridge. That's your hip hop name. Okay.
Awesome.
So, Mark, by alphabetical purposes, through alphabetical purposes, because of alphabet, is going to be picking the next movie. Mark, what is the next movie that we are going to be discussing here on Remakers, Mark?
Well, we need to shift gears, probably a couple of gears, actually.
Yeah.
We need to...
we're doing Smoking the Bandit again?
Yes, exactly. No, wait. Who? I think we need to do something a little bit more lighthearted for our next one. And we haven't touched the 80s in a little while. So I thought we should do the 1984 adventure romance thing, comedy thing, Romancing the Stone.
Excellent.
Nice.
Yes.
Looking forward to that one.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a lot of fun.
I've only seen the TV version of it.
Yeah, I might be surprised at what I didn't remember about this movie.
Yeah, I remember watching this with my folks, I think a few times, actually. There's one, I think we've talked before about my father's piracy habits working at the electronics store. I think he had Jewel of the Nile and Romancing the Stone on the same tape, so I think it was sort of a, you know, build your own series in one tape kind of thing. So, yeah, I watch that one a lot. It's a goodie. But it's been a while, probably... I don't know, 20 years, maybe more,
yeah,
25 years.
I haven't watched that since I was a kid.
Yeah. I'm old enough now where I can say I haven't done something in 25 years, which is, I don't know what it is. It's something. I'm old. What can you do? Nice, but good pick, Mark. I like that. Yeah. Okay, so now let's talk about Saving Private Ryan, the plot, tech, and filmmaking changes, and kind of appreciation, just discussion overall, what's the deal with this movie? So the first thing that I think most people would talk about when it comes to Saving Private Ryan is the fact that it is a war film, and it is really one of the most gritty, visceral, tough-to-watch war films in terms of the filmmaking experience and the film-watching experience. So the movie opens with the invasion of Normandy on D-Day, and it is, I would say, unlike anything that's ever been filmed before or since. I don't know. Do you think that's a pretty accurate portrayal? I mean, I think there's certainly been some visceral stuff since, but nothing that quite captured it the way that this movie did. I mean, you are in the thick of things. The first, you know, the scene where they start, I don't know the technical terminology, but where they start spinning the wheel that opens up the front of the boat that they're in, and they literally get mowed back by machine gun fire. Oh, I mean, you don't even get a chance to see where they are. All you've seen thus far are faces and people throwing up from the sea and from nerves. And I mean, it's from the moment that it starts, it doesn't let down for, I don't know, half hour, probably 20 minutes.
It's at least 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's extraordinary and extraordinarily tough filmmaking. So, I mean, I think from an appreciation standpoint, that is, again, really, really hard to watch, but it's something that I'm thankful that it's there because, and Lee, I think you touched on this, or did we talk about this off the air, but you know, that this is as close to war could feel in person on screen. Did we talk about that off screen or off air, or was that on air? Do you guys remember?
The last episode, I think Lee
mentioned pre-production.
Okay. Got it. Oh, did he? Okay.
Mark and I just said opposite things.
Got two different answers.
We have a continuing feud about facts.
Got it. Well, Lee, why don't you give just a brief summary of what you said, just in case people don't remember from part one.
Well, I was talking about the veteran who I had spoken to from the 2nd Armored Division, who said that this is the only movie that he's seen that looks close to what it actually looked like.
Yep.
So he, his name was Sergeant Purcell, and he was commanded a tank platoon. So he went ashore on Omaha Beach on D+1. And the tide was a little higher at the time. When the tank went off the ramp of the LST, it went straight to the bottom of the channel.
Oh,
and they just had to gun it forward and hope that they would come out before the tank filled up with water. So,
jeez.
Yeah,
unreal. It's amazing. Like you see all of this from the movie, and yet you can still hear something that you've never heard before, or that still is unbelievable. You know, I mean, not as though one movie can capture all of war by any means, but like you see a lot in this film, and it's just goes to show how unreal that experience is.
Definitely.
Yeah. Anything else you want to add to as far as how war was presented before we get into the filmmaking side of that, gentlemen?
We should probably give a shout out to the movie Platoon. I mean, it was visceral in a different sort of way, but as I understand it, that one got a lot of props for bringing an appropriate and realistic weight to war.
Especially the mental state of war, I think, in that one, as much as the physical state.
Yeah. Not as much as the sheer death of it, but just the effects on the human soul.
Yeah. Indeed. So let's touch on sort of from a filmmaking perspective, what went into that. And then if there's anything that we think we would maybe do differently or maybe do slightly differently, it doesn't sound as though we want to do anything hugely different just because of how effective it was and how affecting it was as a viewer. But to me, this really balances Hollywood production values and gritty feel. So, I mean, this is a Steven Spielberg movie. He is a master in terms of capturing action, in terms of capturing mood, and this is all of that in an incredible display. Jer and Andy and Lee, you talk about kind of the look of the film. There's a desaturation to that. There's some frame rate stuff. Who wants to start with the discussion of that?
Well, I can just make my one point. I was going to just talk more about what they did, and I find that interesting. And obviously it worked the way that they wanted it to work, but they with the cinematography and the filming of it, they took the cameras and stripped down all of the coating off of the lenses, and then they like you said, clipped it back quite a ways for frame rates, and did a lot of different things. And what they ultimately were trying to do was create a feel like a newsreel at the time, and so to kind of bring the authenticity to it. But one of the side effects of that was that especially in the high action scenes, you had that kind of clipping feel where things would happen, explosions and things became very, very crisp and a lot more defined. Which wasn't necessarily the intention, but it became very effective. And so to me, all of it, but especially a lot of the camera stuff that they did, is Spielberg and the cinematographers using filmmaking and filmmaking techniques to tell a story the way that they wanted to, which is one of the big arguments right now with a lot of movies is, special effects, are they good or bad? CG, is it good or bad? And this was using all of those tools the right way, and not let's just use them because we have them, a la Star Wars prequels.
Yeah. You know, there is so much violence can take many forms, right? I think there is violence that could be seen as glamorizing itself. There's violence that can be seen as sexy. I mean, like we talked about 300, you know, I mean, there's certainly a brutality to that, but there's like a dance to that movie too, you know, where the action is slow motion. And there is some slow motion stuff in this, but it's mostly you are meant to be put in the place of those soldiers there. And it's, I mean, incredibly violent and incredibly brutal and gruesome. So, I mean, this is violence that does not glamorize itself. It does not glamorize war.
Yeah, it's not dramatized at all.
Right. It does quite the opposite, yeah. Andy, you talked about the desaturation side of that. Do you want to touch on that a little bit?
Sure. Jerry kind of touched a little bit on the filmmaking as well. The movie was, I think, intentionally desaturated of color to give it a, it's not black and white, but it's a color film, but it's just the colors aren't as vibrant and don't pop like we would normally see, I think, especially in movies released in the last few years. And that was, I believe that was done intentionally to give it a vintage quality. It's almost like, you know, doing a sepia filter in your picture or something like that. And I remember thinking at the time, like, wow, this looks so realistic. This looks like, you know, like every picture of the war I've ever seen. But then you have to think, well, wait a second, you know, the world wasn't desaturated back then. The colors were vibrant back then. It's just, we never, and the pictures that we see today, they aren't, because the
we don't know that.
True. We don't know that. But even though it isn't an illusory effect, it really adds a lot of legitimacy to the story, in that it just immediately, everything looks like we expect it to look in terms of the timeline and the historical accuracy of things. You know, whether that would have looked as good had the color been just transmitted true, you know, that may have been jarring to our, to the audience, which may have then kind of been a hurdle for the audience to get over. So they may have chosen to do this just to kind of ease the audience's passage into this time and place of the story. I don't know. It's a long-winded theory.
Yeah. No, I think that's right on. You know, this is going to sound really silly and kind of cliche, but this is like pre-Instagram. You know, this was pre-filters being a thing in the world, right? So now it feels kind of Instagram-y. I was actually surprised at how it wasn't as desaturated. It wasn't as much desaturated as I thought it was when we were talking about it in pre-production, then having watched it. So I borrowed Lee's Blu-ray copy, and it's a beautiful transfer. It's really rich and really lovely. And it had a lot more color oomph to it than I remembered the first time. I remember it being really washed out, but I think that was more the battle scenes. But there's some like really vibrant greens and blues in there. So it's not desaturated per se. I think it's just a really unique saturation. It kind of feels filtery, if you will.
Yeah.
I think just to add to that point, I guess, I think that, well, I suspect that the color in the battle scenes was desaturated maybe to avoid an NC-17 rating.
Right. I've heard of some movies. Realistic.
Yeah. I've heard of some movies doing that where they tone down the color, like Taxi Driver. They had to tone down the color of the final scene to avoid an X rating. So I wonder if that had something to do with it. But I also do think that desaturating the color helps the audience a bit, because most of us have only seen black and white photos of the war. So it kind of bridges a gap, I guess.
Yeah, it kind of puts you in that time and place in a way that you don't even necessarily know in the moment, but it's kind of a subconscious thing. Yeah, I could totally see that.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think that costumes and props can go a long way in just setting the period, but the colors presented in the film definitely put the audience in the mood that the filmmakers want. I think it could just be as simple as that.
Definitely. Yeah. I agree.
Yep. When you think of like, you know, somebody in the modern day, Fincher does it a lot. Soderbergh especially does it, like in something like Out of Sight, where, you know, entire different areas of the movie, like the Florida scenes are like basically full yellow and Detroit is full blue. I mean, you know, so filmmakers have continued to do that in ways that are interesting, but this was sort of its own unique palette that put you in that time and place. Andy, you mentioned something that was really interesting about how the training happened amongst the actors. So usually in movies like this, they go through some sort of boot camp as actors. So do you want to talk a little bit about what you knew about that?
Yeah. And I will say my knowledge comes from IMDb trivia section. But the members of the squad, so the members under the characters under Captain Miller's command, those actors underwent a week-long boot camp to kind of get them into training mode for this role. Matt Damon was not a part of that group. He did not go through this training, and that was intentional to keep him separate from the rest of the group so that the actors would have a kind of a natural resentment toward him that would carry over into the screen, to that these characters would feel a resentment for doing all of this work, this dangerous work, and, you know, ultimately costing the lives, you know, to the point where they find him, of two of their men to save the life of this one. So I thought that was a very interesting device in preparation for the movie, which to me seemed very effective.
Yeah, agreed. And it's hard not to root for Matt Damon, you know, like he's such a good dude. You know, I just want to help Matt Damon out just in life in general. Not that he really needs my help.
It's like, I think he's doing okay.
Yeah. Maybe he can return that, huh? Damon, huh?
Yeah. He can buy you a zoo.
Yeah. Indeed. Yeah. I bought a zoo. But at the same time, I think that was a smart technique and very interesting. I wonder how much that came through, how much he realized that came through. I'm sure it was purposeful, and I'm sure he knew it was happening, obviously, because he wasn't hanging out with them. So, you know, that helps. But that's pretty interesting. Lee, you, as kind of the definitive World War II historian here, so you have a huge interest in war, not like in like war, yay, like, but war culture and war history. And so this was your pick. And you touched on a little bit about why you chose this movie in part one, as far as kind of the importance of showing what goes into war, both the machinations of it and the brutality of it. But at the same time, you talked about some struggles that you had kind of with the historical side of things. Do you want to touch on some of those?
Yeah, well, I had a long list of reasons why I wanted to talk about this movie, but a couple of... I had some umbrage with the casting. You know, when they go into the Norman village and it's raining and they meet up with members of the 101st who are trying to take the town, they're kind of split in half. There's half of the company is on the other side of the town, and then... our squad that we're with meets up with the other half, and Paul Giamatti is there as an airborne sergeant. And at the time that I saw this, I didn't really know any better, but now watching it again, I'm like, really? Paul Giamatti making it into the airborne? I don't think so. It's like, he's very, I don't know. He's almost clumsy, has a hard time getting around. He's quite hefty. There's no way he would have ever made it through airborne training, so I have an issue with that.
But he's got great endurance, though.
Apparently, well, he must be a brilliant tactician or something like that. But
well, he did knock down that brick wall.
Yeah, I think that was
On a little side note, I had forgotten about all of the great little cameos in this movie.
Oh man,
Paul Giamatti, Ted Danson, Dennis Farina. So many other ones. Yep. They're just these little one-off roles, and you never see them again, but man, they were good. So good.
Yeah.
Bryan Cranston was in there.
Yeah.
With one arm.
Yeah. Dale Dye is in there. He usually has a cameo in all of the movies that he advises on.
He was the guy who put the actors through the boot camp. Who is he in the movie?
He's part of George Marshall's staff. He's the one who speaks up and says, you know, there's no way we're going to find him. And, you know, it's, you know, if we send a squad in there, they're just going to get killed and whatever. So that's Dale Dye.
And he weren't wrong.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting. And then how about on the story side of things?
Well, it's based on a true story. It's based on one paragraph in Band of Brothers, but I even did a little more research today. And it's even less accurate than I had originally thought. I used to think that, you know, the part about his mother receiving all three telegrams on the same day was true. That's not true. She received them all within like a 3-week period. Two of his brothers were killed, but one was missing in action in the movie. All three died. And it's... they said that like he was a private in the 101st, but he was actually a sergeant. And it wasn't a combat squad who went to find him. It was an army chaplain. And it wasn't even so much that the army chaplain went to find him. He had once private... well, his name is Nyland. His name is Frederick Nyland. Once he had regrouped with his company, he'd gotten the news that one of his brothers had been killed and the other one was missing in action. So he wanted to go to the village of San Mariglise to find the grave of the brother that was killed in Normandy. And while they were there, he was there with the army chaplain. While they were there looking, they found the grave of his other brother And then they found the grave of his brother that he was looking for. So at that moment, he learned that he was the only surviving son. And then the army chaplain is the one who decided that he had to write up papers to send him home. And at first, a little bit like the movie, Sergeant Nyland refused to go home. And he said, I'm just going to stay here. I mean, there's no reason for me to go home. And it took, I think, a direct edict from George C. Marshall to tell him you're going home whether you want to go or not. So
that message was sent to him, whereas in the movie that did not happen.
Right.
Got it.
But, you know, in thinking of a remake of this, I wonder how interesting it would be to tell this story, because it's told from the point of view of the squad that goes to rescue him. What if it's told from, you know, Private Ryan's point of view, just like it happens? You know, he gets the news about his brothers. He meets up with an army chaplain, and the rest of the movie is the chaplain trying to convince him that he has to go home.
It'd be a very different film.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it would be an interesting story to tell.
Yeah. Get in the brain of a little bit more and the grief. I mean, he's given a moment to grieve, but I mean, truly a moment, which, you know, is probably very realistic in terms of when you're watching your back at all times and barely able to close both eyes to sleep to really focus on that. But to give a little bit more time to ponder that would be really interesting.
Yeah, I think so too. But Paul Giamatti does not belong in this movie.
So. That's really the point of all
coming
this.
Back around.
Really stuck on Paul Giamatti. Jeez, yeah. What did Giamatti ever do to you?
I like him as an actor. I don't buy him as an airborne sergeant at all. So,
fair enough. Yeah, there was a pretty killer cast in this. I did appreciate that. It was just like every scene was like a new, but it never felt like a cameo, I guess. It just felt like actors and a lot of really good actors. So I get your use of cameo, Andy, but it never quite felt that way to me. Whereas like, I don't know, Tropic Thunder, Tom Cruise. Yeah. Well, he's actually a pretty big part of that, but you know what I mean? Like it wasn't done for gimmicky effect. It was just like, let's just get the best guys that want to work with Steven Spielberg and want to do this. Like Ted Danson felt weird, but at the same time, he was perfect. You know, that one struck me as a little bit weird the first couple times I saw it, and this time it just felt totally natural. So, you know, it just depends.
When I watched this again and, you know, remembered that he was playing a Pathfinder captain, after looking at him, I thought, you know, if Band of Brothers had been made in the 80s, I think he would have been cast as Dick Winters.
Yeah.
Because his portrayal in Saving Private Ryan is so similar to what Winters was like and how Damian Lewis portrayed him.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah.
Got it.
Okay.
Jerry, you had a comment here about kind of the ebb and flow of interest in war films and sort of where we're at right now. Do you want to touch on that a little bit?
Well, this seemed to, I don't know if this was the cause of it or the result of it, but this seemed to come out in a time period where interest in World War II was very much at a high level. I think somewhere right in this general time period, we had that terrible Pearl Harbor movie.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we had this, and then this kind of spawned. What's that show, Lee?
Schmand of something.
Band of Brothers. And then again, after that, is it The Pacific or just Pacific?
The Pacific.
The Pacific. Well,
and then around this time was The Thin Red Line, too, the Terrence Malick.
Yep.
That was like, I think, same year.
Yeah.
And it wasn't long after that we had a couple of excellent Clint Eastwood movies, right? The Letters from Iwo Jima.
Flags of Our Fathers, and yep.
So, yeah, it just seemed like there was a very heightened sense of community interest or social interest in World War II. And I think a lot of that was coming from the fact that generation was on its way out rapidly. I mean, we don't have that many World War II vets left.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that a lot of it came from that and really kind of desiring to know about it and glean information from these people that were firsthand there before they're gone. And so I guess the thought that I had or the question that I posed was, are we still at that point? Would a World War II movie now be as significant, even if it was as well done as Saving Private Ryan was, would it be as significant now as it was when it came out? Just because of where we are societally, if that's a word.
I like to think that any movie that's sufficiently well made is going to be important. Yeah. The social trends only affect how likely it is to get the movie funded.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And the director behind it, if it's a passion project like this was for Spielberg, yeah. Yep, I think that's a good capture.
One thing to note about that sort of, I guess, upswing in popularity of, you know, World War II history and that sort of thing, it may have had something to do with September 11th, because the first two episodes of Band of Brothers premiered on HBO 2 days before September 11th. And I think there was this sense of patriotism, I guess, that permeated our culture for a very long time, like more so than it had previous to those attacks. I think something like Band of Brothers came out at just the right time, I guess, or just the wrong time, however you want to look at it.
Like, if you look at the trends of movies, usually there's like one that starts the trend, and then a year to 2 years later, there are those that having been made because of that trend. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's very rare that a trendsetter does something, and then 2 months later, there's a smattering of things that are the same. It's always like you have to, like, you know, you just have to make a big movie, right? Especially for big war epics like this. So, you know, this was 98. And so 2000, 2001, we start to get those movies made. So, I mean, it makes sense in terms of the rolling out of that. And then I think that could have sort of stoked those fires a little bit too.
Yeah. And I think that this movie kind of set the tone for all of that. Because when I look back, I can't think of any major war epics prior to Saving Private Ryan that did as well. And I can't think of any that were quite as gritty either that might have something to do with its success. And I will say that Band of Brothers probably would not have happened without Saving Private Ryan.
Yeah. Yep. I would say Apocalypse Now is gritty, but in a way that is quite different. It's not gritty in the battle sense. It's gritty in the mental sense, kind of like Platoon, like you mentioned, Mark.
Platoon too.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Maybe Casualties of War.
Yep. Even like Jacob's Ladder, you know, where that's like a PTSD thing. You know, I mean, that had a big military presence.
And Born on the 4th of July, the Tom Cruise.
Oliver Stone.
Oliver Stone. Which also makes me wonder, are we going to hit a swing now where we're going to kind of hit a phase of really well done, thoughtful, not passion projects might not be the right word, but you know, people... directors and filmmakers desiring to tell really well-made stories about Vietnam?
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
It's hard to say. Or the Gulf War.
But a lot of it was coming so close to it. Like Apocalypse Now came out, when did that come out? Late 70s?
79, I think.
Yeah, I mean, we were barely done with it when that came out. And Platoon and some of this other stuff that came out in the 80s. I mean, a lot of that was so much, it was so political in nature. I mean, Platoon, maybe not so much. I think Platoon was much more of a different metaphor, but there was a lot of Vietnam war movies that seemed to come out in the 80s that were pandering to us, wanting society to be okay with what happened there and not really telling the true story. I mean, we kind of talked about this a little bit with Good Morning Vietnam, but I don't know that there's really been a Saving Private Ryan movie about Vietnam.
Yeah.
Probably not.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. It seems like the news cycle moves much more quickly now. I mean, think about like Hurt Locker and Zero Dark Thirty happened in the midst of those respective conflicts, really. You know, I mean, we were still in Iraq and still in Afghanistan when those came out. So, I mean, it felt like of the time. You know, it didn't feel like it was shifted back in time like that. So that feels like where it's at right now, or something like, you know, Oliver Stone's directing an Edward Snowden movie. Sorry.
Gert Ferber.
You know, so Bert Ferber. Gert Ferber. You know, so it feels like the news cycle is more current now, even like United 93 and World Trade Center. I mean, it's those were still a bit after September 11th, but it was not too far removed from that. So it feels like the cycle is the now versus the then. But again, I think maybe we're just waiting for that Saving Private Ryan-esque pullback.
And if you look at culture in general, we're in the 70s right now with sensibilities, with fashion. Like, I mean, it's all kind of this cyclical thing. And what I see is the 30s and the 70s are kind of hitting resurgence to some degree. So I'm assuming that there's going to be a lot of hippies and prohibition soon.
we are making a lot of...
I guess prohibition was a little earlier than that.
We are making a lot of movies about the 80s these days.
That's true.
That's true, yeah. Too.
Yep. We just didn't have any military conflict then. Or we're waiting for our Iran-Contra story.
Yeah. Or we could remake Charlie Wilson's War.
Oh, that was a good film. I'd be down for that. So the last thing I want to touch on is, so this is a Steven Spielberg movie, as we've touched on already, but, you know, Steven Spielberg has a sort of an MO, right? So, I mean, he has a lot of MOs in terms of the people with whom he works, the director of photography that he works with, that use of light. So, you know, in a lot of his movies, there's really high contrast between very dark areas and very bright areas that sort of like add a glow to that, and that was present in this movie. But the thing that he's more known for, even than his filmmaking side of things, is his emotional side of things. Some people view it as just tying into how people want to feel when they watch movies. Other people feel that it's very manipulative. And this movie is kind of weird in that spectrum, or it's more ambiguous on that spectrum. I don't feel like it's on the manipulative side of things, but I also feel like there is definitely, he definitely is in this movie. You know, he has a viewpoint in this film. To me, the thing that stuck out the most was not necessarily his choice of direction, but was the score. The score to me was surprisingly present. And that to me felt very Spielbergian. And I can't remember, was this John Williams?
This is John Williams. I mistakenly thought it was James Horner at first, but it is John Williams.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's, you know, and few people can pen a cinematic melody like John Williams for sure. But, you know, I think they made choices to score this in a way that it wasn't quite as obvious as cueing the strings, right? It never had that moment where it was just like, obviously, like, you cry now. Although, again, we'll get to this.
You cry now.
You cry now. But, you know, it wasn't forceful.
I'd venture that there were moments like that, actually.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You think so?
I think,
say more about that.
The framing devices at the beginning and the end of the movie.
We'll get there.
Elise had said.
What about the score?
The score was a very, very palpable element of those scenes. Everything about that movie, everything about those scenes, score included, were tailor-made to make you feel the feelings.
And all I think the feelings.
That all of them. And I'm not saying that I don't know if I would necessarily want them to be removed from the film, but at the same time, I think we talked about this in pre-production, and it made me wonder, like, what would this movie look like if those bookends were removed and we didn't have that emotional tie-in to Private Ryan's later life? Like, if this movie just stood on its own two feet as the war story, and even getting rid of...
But it's ultimately deceptive, because the beginning part, you assume it's Tom Hanks, right?
I agree with you, because it's made you think that you're looking at Tom Hanks and...
Yeah.
It's a twist.
To feel the feelings.
Twist.
And I think that the whole, like, earn this line, as my wife said, it's like, wow, thanks for that burden for the rest of my life.
Yeah, no pressure.
That's great. Appreciate it. Like, you know, that's a big dollop of melodrama that I don't feel that movie needed. We're already, like, you know, just completely beat up by that point in the movie. Like, got the emotional snot kicked out of us. We don't need that either.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's war can be seen as something that is dehumanizing in a million billion different ways. And so I want to give him credit for adding humanity to it. And I think writing good characters, portraying good characters, portraying interesting, you know, lots of varied types of people in this did a lot for that. The thing that one of my strengths and weaknesses as a human being is that I can empathize with just about anybody. And so, like, to me, it feels like anytime I worry about whether this is getting overly dramatic, I think about someone that went through that and what that must have felt like. So it's like kind of putting yourself in those shoes. Now, that doesn't change things from a cinematic perspective. I agree that the bookends are really weird or the framing devices are really weird. And I don't think that they're the best thing for the film. But I also think about those people for whom, you know, maybe this movie was made. Maybe those people couldn't even see it because it was too intense. But I think about those people having lived through that, and then I come around on that a little bit more. The fact that it is deceptive actually is a selling point to me in that regard, because it's unique in that it shifts you throughout the movie. You know, the not the main character, but sort of where your focus lies changes a little bit throughout the movie. And so I kind of like that they did that. I don't know. I don't have a firm answer. I guess that's what I'm trying to say poorly, but it is really, I want to be okay with it, because I think for those people that need it the most, that's going to be the most helpful to them.
I don't feel I need to be okay with them. I think we can do without the obvious melodrama. I think that we can include some more emotional hooks throughout the film, which just without making it so cheesy, which I don't know. I'm okay with Spielberg in general, because his projects do include a ton of great ideas and some really excellent filmmaking. And then there's these really cheesy moments to me are his fatal flaw. And I think that we can do the great stuff without the cheesy stuff. To remove them altogether, I think might be bad, or I don't know, depends on your taste. Because I think if you don't have the melodrama, you end up with the Hurt Locker, and it can be really harsh and maybe too gritty.
Yeah.
But you know, especially because the Hurt Locker wasn't as gory as this film was. Yeah, just to do it in a way that's a little bit more tasteful, I think, is what I would want.
Okay.
I could have maybe done without that moment at the end where Upham notices that German prisoner that they let go is back and firing, you know, trying to capture the bridge. And then, you know, at the end when they have their hands up, he, you know, and he is basically telling him to shut up and he won't, and he just shoots him. I thought that was a little too easy. Yeah. And it felt like a moment to like almost pacify the audience a little bit, like give the audience a sense of justice. But I don't think it needed to be in the movie myself.
If there's anyone I wanted to see in a post-war bookend, it would have been Upham. I wanted to see what his post-war life was like.
Well, and he was writing a book about it. Like, your, not sequel, but there's like your alternate viewpoint of what came of this, you know?
And his book was called Band of Brothers.
Funny.
But like, I would have liked to have seen how he dealt with his own emotional crisis of letting his comrades die because he was too scared to go up and fight. And then shooting a prisoner.
Yeah, I didn't care for his story arc, but I think a little bit of resolution for him would have been better.
Yeah.
Well, I think there's something to be said for his being the moral standard for the film. You know, when they were maybe going to execute that the prisoner early on, and then he essentially, you know, it didn't entirely, but basically convinced Tom Hanks not to kill him and let him go. So, I mean, he was sort of the moral center for a while. And to see him come around on that, I think, is a reflection on just how morals gets trumped by emotions. And I mean, that's not the easiest thing in the world, but it's a very true thing. And that even the moral center can go off center in that way. So I agree that the arc is weird that way, but I do like what that presents in terms of war as a big picture.
Yeah. And I mean, it's true. I mean, that moment is very true to life, to, you know, things that happened during the war, just people who just couldn't fathom killing another human being. Then they see their friends getting killed and they change their minds really quickly. So that it kind of summed up that in that moment, which is very true.
Oh, I'm sure.
So, yeah. Yeah.
Well, on that chipper note, let's wrap up this episode. Thanks so much for tuning in. You know, this is a tough movie, but I like that we did this. Lee, good pick. I think it's a tough movie to watch, but I'm really glad that we did, even though Andy texted me at the end. He's like, man, that was tough. And I said, yep, I'm in the middle of it right
this
now.
This was hard. This was very hard.
Yep.
Yep.
But yeah, I'm glad that we did it at the same time, and I think this discussion shows that. So if you would like to find out more information about this podcast or any other podcast or blog on the Math is Hard Network, check us out at mathishard.net. There you can find show notes as well, where you can find links to actors, actresses, movies, and other links discussed in this episode. You can find us on both Twitter and Facebook at username mathishardnet, so hit us up and follow us there. Our next episode will be released on September 7th with our For Shame discussion of The Maltese Falcon, and then after that on September 21st with our discussion of Romancing the Stone. So those should both be a lot of fun, so stay tuned for those. Gentlemen, thanks again for your time and for your chats, and until the next time, may the Force be with you.
And also with you.